You're listening to the Pop Czar Podcast.
I got two things to tell you, all right? One, I don't like you. You see you every week in this mall. I don't like shiftless layabouts. You're one of these f***ing loser mall rat kids. You don't come down here to work or shop. You hang out all day. Act like you f***ing live here. Well, I have no respect for people with no shopping agenda.
Is this what's known as motivated salesmanship?
It's movie time.
What's up? It's movie time. It's time for movies because it's time for movies because it's movie time. It's circular logic, but it works. Welcome back. This is Pop Czar's own movie time podcast. That's right. We talk about the movies with an exclamation mark because we're serious about the movies. I'm Nathan Evans, managing editor of PopCzar.com. You've heard me on other podcasts. You've probably muted me, but I'm back again talking about movies with none other than our own co-host, Mr. Ethan Brehm. Ethan, welcome back.
Snoochie Boochie.
Yeah, that's the only time in the world. That's the only time in the world where that's going to make a lot of sense, because we're talking about two movies today that on the surface may seem like they have a lot in common, but they really don't, but they kind of do. Kind of like a Kevin Smith movie. You think it makes sense, it doesn't, but then it does.
Yeah. I was the one who suggested Mallrats, because as you told me off the record, you're not a huge Kevin Smith fan.
Off the record, he says, and then he says it on the record. Remind me never to tell you where the bodies are buried.
Well, I figured it would come up in this episode somewhere.
Man, yeah, I am not the biggest fan of Kevin Smith, aka Silent Bob, who, by the way, should go back to being a little more silent. But no.
Yeah, I can see how people aren't fans of Kevin Smith movies, but I am wondering if there are any that you are kind of a fan of.
No, I am. I have Kevin Smith stories. I've met him.
So, okay.
Let's just say that let's introduce the movies we're going to talk about. So
sure.
You've already kind of spilled the beans. So one of the films we're going to be talking about is 1995's Mallrats, which is the sophomore film from Kevin Smith, writer and director. And the second film we're going to be talking about is 2020's Jasper Maul, which, again, is also, I believe, the sophomore film from documentary filmmakers Bradford Thompson and Brett Whitcomb. You may not know them, but you may have heard of what they've done. The most notable thing they've done was directed the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling documentary from 2012, which I've actually seen. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. But I also enjoyed The Glow Show on Netflix, which I believe was inspired by it. Netflix, you know what they do? They do a lot of documentaries.
Yeah.
They really do. Not all good ones, but they do them. Amazon's been trying to ape that game because Amazon released Jasper Maul, which might be a little ironic, but we'll get into that. So to answer your question, let's go back to Kevin Smith. So he is an acquired taste. Kevin Smith is the kumbacha of filmmakers. On the surface, if you hear how it's made, it sounds rancid and gross and awful and just off-putting. But if you like the taste, then it's a good taste. But if you don't like the taste, then it's serendipity. Because all that nastiness all that bilge just comes up. So here's my killer Kevin Smith story, and we'll get into it. November 2000, that's right, the millennium. November 2000, I was in a place, I think it was Emporia State College in the middle of Kansas, and a friend of mine who was a giant Kevin Smith fan, just enormous Kevin Smith fan, like the kind, he wore the Clerks t-shirt, he had everything. Kevin Smith was in town. This was when he was starting his, I would say, second career, as a storyteller, which I think you probably are familiar with too. And he was there. And by the way, to put this chronologically, this was on election day of 2000. This was the day of George W. Bush versus Al Gore. So we spent our election night listening to Kevin Smith tell a story. And the cool part was he was telling the stories. You've seen his act. He talks about Superman. He talks about the Clerks. So on this particular day, his intern would come out and give him updates on the election. Right? So he's like, oh, Al Gore won Florida. He's like, enjoy your effing wooden president. And then 10 minutes later, wait, scratch that. The whole night was like this with Kevin Smith. That's how I knew. Okay, I'll just say this, Ethan. That's how I knew who didn't win the election that night. Because if you all know what happened, it took a while to figure it out. We were the first audience to see the Clerks TV show, which was, well, let's just say troubled. And he was also putting out auditions for a new Jay and Silent Bob movie, which would become Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And he was actually in town to scout locations. I don't know if any of those locations made it into the film, But I know Mark Hamill did, and Carrie Fisher did, so that's all I need to know. But that's my Kevin Smith story. We met him out there. My friend went ecstatic. He got all his stuff signed. I think he had to pay a little fee. I heard the story of Superman and the giant spider for the billionth time. By the way, I think that story is full of crap, by the way. I don't think that's a true story. But that's just me. That's just me. So there's my Kevin Smith story. And I'll get into whether I like some of his movies later or not, because I've seen them all.
Yeah.
I've seen them all, including Tusk. Have you seen Tusk?
Oh, it's it might come up.
It might come up.
I have a different opinion on it than most people.
Most people think it sucks, so that means you must think it doesn't suck.
I actually, it's one of my favorites.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I do like it.
You like Justin Long?
I actually really liked him in the movie. Let me do a quick thing on Kevin Smith for myself. So I went through a phase in college, which makes sense given demographic. I was taking film classes and like analyzing, and I got into independent film at the time, and I just loved the idea of Kevin Smith. Probably before I even watched one of his movies, I loved this universe he creates and how they're all connected. I thought that was super cool.
It's the View. Is that the View Askew universe?
The View Askew universe.
Yeah.
And then I watched them in order. Probably, the six movies at the time, I watched them in order, probably within like two or three nights. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of didn't. There were maybe one or two movies that I really, really liked. The rest of them I was kind of just lukewarm to. I respected it. Other than Dogma, which for other reasons, but I just loved how he kind of operated in his own world, with kind of weird humor, and he was never really afraid of his own voice, it seemed like, and I kind of thought that was cool, and there was just this weird enigma about his movies.
Kind of ironic about the voice thing, though, if you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. So, back then, though, it felt like it. When I was in college, that's what I felt like. And you watch his older movies, and you do feel that. Clerks and Mallrats and Chasing Amy a little bit. But, yeah, I just liked his creativity. And there was something about it that it felt very homemade. But and I think that's what put me off about Clerks. But Mallrats, it felt like a homemade movie with a $6 million budget, which is kind of what it was.
So,
and I liked it.
So
it was cool.
Are you saying that you like Mallrats better than Clerks?
I'm saying that Clerks is a better movie, but Mallrats is more enjoyable for me.
You know what's funny? I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for his things right now, and Mallrats is the only movie listed, with the exception of the upcoming Kilroy Was Here, that is Kevin Smith is not the editor of his own film.
And I think
you feel that a little bit in the movie, which we can get into. So you're a fan of Mallrats. Let's just say this real quick, though, because this is something that Jasper Mall shares with Mallrats a little bit. It wasn't really well received, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for all intents and purposes, Mallrats was critically reviled. It bombed at the box office, which doesn't mean anything, as we all know, because that's usually, like, bombing at the box office and being critically reviled is usually the first step to becoming a cult classic.
Yeah.
It's sort of a trial by fire.
Kevin Smith just churns out cult classics. Like, all of his movies are just a cult classic after a cult classic. It's kind of weird.
Well, you know what's really funny, though, is that I think Mallrats works better as a modern movie than it does a classic movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those films, and I think we see this a lot, by the way, which makes me discount critics a little bit, because when you see a movie for the first time, you're seeing something that you've never seen before. You're seeing it without context. You're seeing it for what it is. And a lot of times, movies don't work like that. Like, there are some people who talk and say, we've had this discussion before, that a movie should stand on its own, its gifts should be apparent, like it should please you on the first view. Well, that's total BS. That's total crap. Sometimes movies need to age. They need to age into themselves. Like, for example, Ben Affleck's in Mallrats. He looks terrible in Mallrats. He is ill-dressed. Okay, I had this in my notes. The Ben Affleck character, right? Not his first movie, but Ben Affleck, his character, he works at a place called Fashionable Male, but he looks terrible. Like, his clothes don't fit. It looks like everybody just bought clothes off the rack. Like, everybody
looks
terrible.
He looks like David Byrne. Exactly. From Stop Making Sense.
Exactly. Just type in David Byrne giant suit. He looks worse than that. But you look at Ben Affleck now, he's a guy who aged into his own self, and he's a much more competent. Like, even by the time Dogma came out, look, I'll just say it, he's a handsome man, and he was much more handsome the older he got.
Yeah.
But, like, that's how films are sometimes. You have to age into it, and you come back with perspective. And I want to say something. I'm going to defend Mallrats real quick. It's a movie I do not like, by the way. I do not like Mallrats. I do not. But I can appreciate it, and I'll tell you why. So, you have to look at what Kevin Smith was doing in the context of what no one else was doing at the time. 1995, for all intents and purposes, I love saying this, but this is true. You have the big comedies of the time. You have Jim Carrey ascending with the Ace Venturas. You have satire movies like The Brady Bunch. You know, you have the Adam Sandler movies like Billy Madison and all this. You have these films, and Mallrats looks like those films. And I think the reason it does, for whatever reason, the cameras, the editing, whatever, Hollywood was churning out these low-grade comedies that all felt the same. They all felt like safe studio pictures with the same color grading, with the same film stock, with the same, I don't know if you'd call it diegetic music, but you'd have diegetic sound effects. Mm-hmm. Like when someone gets hit on the head, you hear bing, bong, bong, you know, sound effects everywhere. Just from a filmmaking perspective, this does not feel like a Kevin Smith movie. It does not feel like a Kevin Smith movie. This feels like something any run-of-the-mill, like Dunstan Checks In. It just doesn't feel like anything else. And again, I'm not the biggest Clerks fan, but how do you go from this finely crafted piece of indie cinema, black and white or whatever, to this mainstream comedy that doesn't work? But again, I want to give them credit, and this is my final thought real quick, is that when you look at what Kevin Smith was doing, he was setting up something that nobody else was setting up. He was setting up a cinematic universe with his repertoire of familiar actors. He was setting up everything that modern movies are today. He was basically doing what Adam Sandler does. He was setting up this stable of actors who would return again and again to do these low-grade comedies. But whereas Kevin Smith had aims that were higher and, let's just say it, more cerebral, Adam Sandler mired in the muck. Of course, Adam Sandler became the more successful. But Kevin Smith became, I think, the more culty. I think people will be watching Mallrats long after they're watching Little Nicky. But, well, you never know. There's somebody out there's like, wait a minute, Little Nicky's awesome, classic. But we'll talk about Mallrats. But your thoughts, because I know you like this movie, and I want to know why. I want to know who's to blame.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I picked it, because I thought it's not a perfect. It's not. I mean, I really like the movie, but
it's not perfect. You say
to acknowledge, but I'll be the first to acknowledge that it's not a great movie. It's not. This is not. We're not talking Citizen Kane here.
We're talking
Mallrats. And at the time it came out, I mean, people were comparing it to Clerks naturally because it was his follow up. Everyone's like, oh man, Clerks. I mean, you know, a $27,000 movie turned into like this.
Well,
the biggest cult classics of the decade.
Our guy Roger Ebert excoriated the film. Like he just destroyed it. And he also personally attacked Kevin Smith, which I thought was interesting for him.
Yeah, well, so Clerks, everyone's comparing it to it, and for all its flaws, Clerks has a great deal of intelligence. But it also kind of plays around with this and contrasts that intelligence with this stupid college humor. And Mallrats is almost just the college humor. And I think I don't know if Kevin Smith just focused on the negative reviews of Clerks at the time, because there were negative reviews talking about and I mean, it's very Clerks is very self-indulgent. I mean, it's like Woody Allen writing for a Dawson's Creek or something. Like, mm-hmm. Nobody talks like this. Everyone has the same like IQ of 160, and they're just talking to each other, but they're not. But they don't have an IQ of 160. They just talk like they do. It's like, you know, when you graduate high school and go to college and take that one psychology or philosophy class freshman year, and mm-hmm. then you like learn all these new theories and ideas, and then now you think you're the smartest person ever. But then you look back, and then you really weren't. 10 years later, you look back.
Exactly.
And like, I was pretty dumb. Yeah, that's kind of what Kevin Smith movies are back his early stuff. And I think with Mallrats, he was just trying to break away from the diatribes and stuff.
Well, the characters never feel like they're talking with each other. They always feel like they're talking at each other. Like you said, they're espousing these narrative dumps and these going on these long soliloquies and these long exegeses on comic books and sex and pot, which, by the way, sound pretty cool if you're into that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing, though. The problem that I think with Mallrats for me is that one thing I noticed is that Kevin Smith does really, really, really well and really, really poorly at the same time is that he picks his actors really well, and then he picks his actors really badly. And I wonder how much of the studio's involvement in Mallrats resulted in dialogue coming from the wrong people. For example, Mallrats was the debut of Jason Lee, correct? Was this his first film? His first real
first
film?
First film? Yeah, he did some skateboard stuff before.
But. Yeah, and I looked into it. He actually did like some other little stuff before, so it's like, but this is his first real starring role. Mm-hmm. And he's excellent in Mallrats. He's really good.
He carries the movie.
He is that. Yeah, he's so much better than every other person in this film. Yeah. And this is cool. This is why he saves this movie without Jason Lee. Mm-hmm. But he's not the star. It's this other guy, Jeremy London,
who's awful.
Who is so awful. He's so bad. The only person worse than him is Claire Forlani. Claire Forlani, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. What accent is she doing?
Yeah, I saw that in I'm not sure if I even picked up on that.
Well, can I
think
I recorded
she's American,
it.
Isn't she?
Well, according to Wikipedia, she is British, but I think she grew up in America, but she seems to be like wavering in and out of an Australian accent. So, I have a little clip real quick, okay? I just call this clip Brandy's accent. So, here we go. Let's listen to Claire Forlani
Forlani.
Okay, whatever. Claire as Brandy. Here's her accent, real quick. Here we go.
We're over, T.S.
Oh, come on. I thought we weren't going through this breakup makeup shit anymore.
No, we're not, so you could just forget about making up.
Listen to you. Why don't you just admit it?
Admit what?
That this isn't about just what happened on the roof up there. You're using that as an excuse because you don't have the guts to stand up to your father.
Maybe I don't.
Come on, Brandy. What about Florida?
You've just humiliated me in front of the entire school, the community, the nation, for God's sakes. You seriously damaged my father's career. You insult me with that good cop, bad cop routine. And now you have the gall to ask me if I still want to go on vacation.
I was going to propose to you in Florida.
Okay, and that other deadwood is Jeremy London, who, by the way, like looks like he was designed in a lab from 1994.
He looks like he was Michael J. Fox on, but if Michael J. Fox went through all the Captain America juice.
Yeah, the hairstyle, the fop, I thought we were rid of it, but I saw that hairstyle fop come back a few years ago on the TV show, which, by the way, I love this show, Cobra Kai, and the son of, I forget the main character's name, but the son, he had that fop. I was like, don't bring that back. Don't bring that back. Don't bring the flannel back. Nobody does that. Nobody wants that. That's like bell bottoms in the 70s. Stop it. But no. So I don't know her accent, but I will come back to the accent later. But here's the thing, though. Here's my thought. When you're listening to this film, if you just listen to it, Jason Lee sounds about as natural speaking this dialogue as Samuel Jackson sounds when he's reading Quentin Tarantino dialogue.
Yeah.
Like, you need Kevin Smith needs the right actors to talk the dialogue. When they're not talking it, it sounds awful. And I do have a clip later.
Look at Clerks, yeah.
Exactly. And I do want to come back to that later because nothing in this movie dates it quite as bad as Shannon Doherty. Because Shannon Doherty, like for those youngsters who don't remember the dark times, but there was a TV show called Beverly Hills 90210. And I think it's one of the most inspirational shows of the late 80s, 90s. Very popular. Set a lot of trends, but none of them good. So Shannon Doherty was the star of it. She played Brenda. By the way, this movie has 90210 all over it, yeah. Ethan. Like, there's even some in-jokes where they call her character Brenda from the
show.
Yeah,
and then I saw that. Yeah, I was like, I didn't get it. I had to look it up because I'd never seen that show.
And her character, Shannon Hamilton, is it Ben Affleck's character, Shannon Hamilton, is actually like a nod, I believe, to her real-life husband. So there's lots of this in this movie. But you won't get any of that unless you know 90210. By the way, they rebooted it. It's still bad. So
shocker.
I know. But people love it, though. People really like that show.
Interesting.
Not me. So
yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go. This is your movie.
I in defense of not in defense of. So Jason Lee to me, I didn't even realize this was his first movie. A, because I don't know a ton about him, and B, because he just is so in tune with his own voice comedically and just like as an actor. Just his charisma and his delivery of these lines. I'm like, okay, you watch Clerks and it's very stiff deliveries. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a bunch of people who are just basically doing a table read, on camera. And that's kind of my thing about Clerks is it feels like just a glorified script where this for all its flaws, feels like a movie. And I liked the because I like the some of the ideas that Kevin Smith has in his philosophy. I mean his pontifications, and especially in this one, it gets a little more comic booky and fandomy with like Star Wars and comic books.
Oh, it goes there. It goes there.
And it even brings in rest in peace Stan Lee, and it, at a time when I don't think 99% of people would have known who Stan Lee looked like. Well, and now 99% of people probably know would not. Yeah,
Ethan, this is my point. Actually, you reminded me of this. Is that this is actually why I think this movie's important cinematically, because I mentioned before that he was setting up a cinematic universe, mm-hmm. but with Stan Lee in there, this was the template for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, it really was, and I wonder if Kevin Feige from Disney understood this. And by the way, Kevin Smith is pretty much a paid shill for these movies now. You know this, right? This is his fourth career. Like, mm-hmm. Kevin Smith has podcasts, and he's online, and he cries every time he hears the theme song of a show, or he cries when he hears about Batman or Superman. He cries when he hears about a Marvel movie. Like, if you want your movie to be represented, doesn't he work for Disney now? Like, does he? Like, I don't understand, but he's so shilly. Like, he sees movies before they come out. He gets privy to it.
Oh yeah, he's very connected.
He's very connected, but again though, the template for the Marvel Cinematic Universe is right here.
Yeah.
So, in fact, a lot of the players are involved too. So it's mm-hmm. crazy. So yeah, so I think, do we have to give credit to Kevin Smith for inspiring the MCU? I think, yeah.
He was doing some stuff that it just took a guy's creativity and a vision to kind of tackle, and no one was doing anything even kind of like this. I mean, you'd have meta moments here and there, but not even close to this. I mean, this literally takes place. They're referencing events in Clerks, but none of the characters are there.
By the way,
still they're referring to each other.
The Stan Lee that's in Mallrats is the same Stan Lee that's in Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
It's the same character. Like, yeah, he's even reading the script from Mallrats.
Yeah.
So, Kevin Smith, you did it. You created this monstrosity. You own this. I think you're right, and I think nowhere is that more apparent in the actor with the actor Brian O'Halloran. Is that his name?
Yeah. Yeah, the guy who played Dante.
Yeah, he played Dante, but you can tell, like, Kevin Smith really didn't have much use for him later as a lead. Like, he shows up as a spare actor, but he only shows up in cameos, because I'll be honest with you, he's not very funny. And this is a problem. Like, I'm glad he's getting work, and I'm glad Kevin Smith likes him. But once you see Jason Lee there, Jason Lee is his star. Yeah. And I think he also, again, I also think he inspired us to have Ben Affleck. And forgive me for saying this. But is Matt Damon in this, or no? That was Chasing.
No, he's
in Chasing Amy. By the way, Chasing Amy is his masterpiece, I think.
It's probably his best movie.
It's so substantially better, like, in directing and writing than anything else he's ever done. I know you may differ on that one, but we're talking. If we could just talk about assembling what people think is a great film, mm-hmm. I don't think he's ever exceeded Chasing Amy just overall as a real movie. Yeah. That feels like a Kevin Smith movie. But it's not my favorite Kevin Smith movie. You know what my favorite Kevin Smith movie is?
Silent Bob, I'm guessing.
No, I think that's Wretched. I think the worst movie he's ever done is the Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
That's the only one I haven't seen.
Oh, I've seen it. Oh, it's terrible.
I was afraid to watch it.
Tusk takes a amazing idea and destroys it.
I like Tusk.
I know you like Tusk. We'll get into Tusk. But no, my favorite Kevin Smith movie is going to surprise you. I actually like this movie. I'm actually a very big fan of this movie. I'm a big fan of Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I forgot about that one. Yeah,
I genuinely like this movie a lot.
No, that is a good one. It even, like, the title wouldn't make you think that it actually has a surprising amount of heart in it, too, which mm-hmm. is kind of weird. And I'm not even a big Elizabeth Banks fan, but...
I like her when she's in the right thing.
Yeah, sure. Seth Rogen, I'm a big Seth Rogen fan, and I've seen literally all of his movies. And he was – that was before he was really – I mean, people knew who he was, but he was not who he is now.
No, this is – this is when he's still in the geeky phase, like the chubby, chubby Jufro phase. I'll just say it like that. Like, where his hair was grown out.
Yeah.
But no, I think he's great in this. I think he's got real charisma with Elizabeth Banks. I think everybody in this movie excels. I think the writing's good. I actually think this is the real sequel to Chasing Amy because it deals with a lot of the same subject matter, and it deals with a lot of the same subject matter in the same way, that you have this open, frank conversation about sexuality and the fluidity of sexuality. And I'll be honest with you, though, but I think going back to Mallrats, you can see the elements of where it could have been. For example, in Mallrats, I just want to make sure I get her name right. You have Claire Forlani. I can't say her name. Claire Forlani is awful in this movie. She is really bad. But you know who's really good? Joey Lauren Adams.
Oh, yeah.
Joey Lauren Adams.
Who plays Amy.
Who plays Amy. She is basically doing an impression of, what's her name? Who's the one who played Bride of Chucky? You know what I'm talking about. Ooh, goodness. What's her name? You know who she is. I know who she is. We all like her.
Bride of Chucky. I haven't seen Bride of Chucky.
What? Okay, stop the podcast. We're gonna go watch all the Chucky movies. No, Jennifer Tilly.
Oh yeah, she sounds just like Jennifer
and
Tilly.
Looks like Jennifer Tilly.
She looks like Jennifer Tilly meets Renee Zellweger.
Exactly. You did it. And I think what happened is that you had all the, and by the way, right around the same, this is when Renee Zellweger would have been gestulating in the Hollywood embryo as well. Mm-hmm. They spit her. And by the way, Hollywood was not kind to Renee Zellweger.
Oh, and she was in a 1995 movie that was maybe my favorite of the year, Empire Records. She was in
Empire Records. And the next year she had her breakout with Tom Cruise in what's that movie? You know it.
Yeah.
Your guy did the movie. God, we're so prepared for this. You know, the guy from Say Anything.
Cusack?
Not John Cusack.
Cameron Crowe,
right?
I thought you were talking about a different Renee Zellweger movie, but I was thinking.
Thought I was talking about a different Renee Zellweger. That's the problem, because there are apparently two of her out there. There's like she went into some cocoon and came out with a different face. Yeah. I don't get it. She's still funny though. I actually like Renee Zellweger very much. She not to get off topic, but she was really good in that movie where she played Judy.
Oh, yeah, Garland. The Judy Garland one.
The movie is not good. The movie is wretched, but she is really good in it.
Jerry Maguire. Yeah.
Like, only one of the most famous movies of the
90s. Yeah, it's like the one thing won Best
money.
Picture.
Did it win Best Picture?
I think so. It was nominated.
Did she win? But she won Best Actress, didn't she? Or Best Supporting Actress?
Yeah. Oh, did she?
Man.
Did not win Best Picture.
No, Cuba Gooding Jr. won Best Supporting
Actor. That's right. They couldn't get him off the stage.
Yeah, and
that
they
was a great acceptance speech.
And then he went and made Boat Trip.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But no, but going back to it though, I do like Jennifer Tilly quite a bit. I like their voice. But going back, she is fantastic. Joey Lauren Adams. She's only in the movie for like 5 minutes total, and half of it's naked. But she's so good in the movie. I wish she had been something else. But you see these planks of wood like Claire Forlani and Jeremy London, they do not belong in this movie. This is not their movie. Yikes.
And Kevin Smith is so hit or miss with comedy. I think he has some really, really great comedic ideas, and he's not a bad comedy writer, but there's some stuff where I think he just drops the ball. Like, I think that final scene at the game show, I think that could have been a lot funnier. He could have used that a lot better. There's some other moments too. Not that it wasn't enjoyable, but I feel like in the hands of another director, it could have been really
It's iconic. Awkward. It feels awkward. Like, there's a scene at the end, and I don't have any clips because the whole thing's terrible, but for those who haven't seen it, it's the game show scene when there's supposed to be the three Lotharios that are, you know, she's trying to pick one. It's basically the build-up to the scene. The whole scene is so ineptly shot and so ineptly written and so ineptly delivered. It's one of the least funny, most painful things I've ever watched in a film.
Yeah, he can't do screwball too well.
No, he can't.
Although, love him or hate him, I do think he works with Jay and Silent Bob pretty well. But I'm not sure how you feel about them, but they're I'm a Jay and Silent Bob fan.
They sashayed their way through a lot of films in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty impressive that they were able to do that. And I'm always a big fan because while I'm not a fan of the characters per se, the last time I think we saw that sort of thing happen was probably like Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, Frankenstein stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what are you doing here? Oh, yeah. Like, oh, you don't need to be in Scream 3. Yes,
yeah,
we do.
Yeah, it kind of was like that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, for no reason. They would just show up.
Yeah.
But, no, I'm actually a big fan of Jason Mewes, actually. I think he's really funny.
He is really funny.
Like, he's really good in certain things. Like, he's genuinely, like, okay, you remember we talked about Keanu Reeves, we talked about Alex Winter, and as, you know, our favorites, but
Bill and Ted.
But we both agreed that while we liked the third movie, Keanu Reeves just didn't seem part of it.
Yeah, he seemed like he was playing some weird
other role. Yeah. Like, Kevin Smith has lost a lot of weight, famously, because he had a heart attack.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really happy for him. Although, dude, you got to get the capri pants off. Don't do that. I'm sorry. Capri pants are not for you. But Jason Mewes has never lost it. He seems exactly the same. He's really good at this role. And I don't think he's – I've only seen him in, like, in one other thing, and that was Zach and Miri.
Yeah,
where he didn't – because Jay and Silent Bob were not in that film, right? But Jason Mewes was, and he was really good. He was actually genuinely funny as another character.
Yeah.
And but, yeah, and I like him in this too, by the way. I think there's a scene at the beginning – near the beginning. It's one of my favorite scenes in Mallrats. This is one of my favorite scenes. See if you agree with me. When you first see T.S. Quint, a.k.a. Jeremy London, you see Brody, Jason Lee, and they're first meeting Jay and Silent Bob, and they're in front of the pet store.
Yeah.
And the charisma and the chemistry between Jason Lee and Jay and Silent Bob is so genuine. Mm-hmm. Like, they just feel like they're friends. Like, it feels so authentic. And I was like, this is the movie. This should have been the movie. Get rid of Jeremy London. Get rid of these characters. Just focus on the mall.
Yeah.
Like, everything else.
He kind of tried to do the same love story thing as Clerks. Like, the characters from Clerks, Dante and Randall, are essentially drawn the same exact way as T.S. and Brody. Like, T.S. and Dante are, for all intents and purposes, are the same character. Randall and Brody are basically the same character with slight differences. And then he basically just does this, you know, he's trying to get this girl back and he's caught between two girls. And it's like, why are we doing this? Like, this should be more hijinks. It should be more screwball stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It should be more just really... and I like it because mall culture in the 80s and 90s was definitely a real thing.
Absolutely,
and, sadly, Mallrats is kind of one of the few films that really explores this hecticness of that. And I just wish there were more. And maybe I like it so much because it's one of the only ones that does, and I feel like there should be more, that really just focuses on this culture. And Smith has you can tell he has a love and admiration for shopping malls and their importance for that generation, but he doesn't quite explore it as well as he could, but almost gets there.
You're exactly right, but I want to add to that is that a lot of movies from the late 80s and the 90s, they did this thing where they felt the subject itself wasn't enough, so they had to add all these horrible B plots. Mm-hmm. And if you forget how revolutionary something like Seinfeld was for the time, when now they're all like this, but back then the show was literally about nothing. There was no overarching theme. There was no gimmick. I mean, they quickly dropped the gimmick that Seinfeld was a stand-up comedian. Like, you remember that. They stopped doing those interstitials. And they just let the character be itself. They let the characters be themselves. And the fun part was seeing these disturbed characters in situations. Like, hey, let's put them in a shopping mall, which they have. Let's put them in a parking garage. And let's see what happens. And I think a lot of times you see these really otherwise good movies saddled with these horrific B-plots. Give you a good example. The first Crocodile Dundee was a great movie. It's very funny. Very funny because we get to see the Crocodile Dundee character in New York. The second movie, he's fighting drug dealers. Like, why is he fighting drug dealers? I don't need that. He's enough, right?
Yeah.
And that's what this movie is. This movie has this unnecessary, horrible B-plot of this stupid romance when it should have just been the characters talking in a mall.
Yeah, and the stuff with Brody and his ex-girlfriend worked, I think, because it wasn't super focused on it.
And it existed in the mall. Literally existed in the mall.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. Like, okay, you have Ethan Suplee as Willem, right? The character who cannot see the picture.
I love that.
It's a funny gag. It outstays its welcome, but it's a funny gag. But that's a mall gag. You've seen that. Yeah. We've all seen those damn things. I could never see them because it turns out I have bad eyesight. But if you could, God bless you. And I hate you. But no. But Imagine a movie where we didn't have any of the Michael Rooker character. I like Michael Rooker, but he's awful in this movie.
Yeah, imagine, shoehorned in.
Yeah, he does not feel right. And so just imagine just meeting Stan Lee. Just imagine, you know, going and trying out women's clothing. Just imagine going to the movies and talking. Just how much better it would have been. I hate to say it. It would have been Clerks, yeah, but in a mall.
Yeah, like or like Dazed and Confused. I think a lot of people were trying to replicate that kind of vibe, the episodic, you know, give it a setting and then just play around with it. But Dazed and Confused didn't focus on its subplots a lot. I mean, I can't really think of the one overarching plot in that movie other than like they're trying to spank the freshman or whatever it was.
Dazed and Confused, the movie that gave us Michael McConaughey. Right?
Yeah, and Ben Affleck, too.
And Ben Affleck, yeah. See, a lot of these things. So Ben Affleck, man, you've had your fingers and everything. But Dazed and Confused, was that 95 or is that 94?
93.
93, really?
Yeah.
Was that Affleck's first movie?
Yeah, it was his first. I'm pretty sure it was his first one. His first one where he had, like, a name, at least.
Yeah, there's a lot of firsts in a lot of these early 90s movies. You got to pick them, though.
Yeah, but they're all kind of trying to be American Graffiti, right? Where it's like this perfect, and American Graffiti had these B plots, but it just was so organic that it was perfect.
Well, but it, American Graffiti had the advantage of one thing this movie does not have. It had the advantage of knowing it was nostalgia.
Yeah.
And
sure.
And I think when we look back at Mallrats now, I said it was better now, and I think you would probably agree. Because now we can look back and see it for the nostalgia it truly was. Yeah. But maybe it wasn't executed properly. But the movie that stuck out to me, the movie that Mallrats reminded me most of all, the movie that I think Mallrats wanted to be more than anything else, was Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High is a great movie, great characters, takes place a lot in a mall, by the way. Mm-hmm. Lots of, I hate to say it, let's just say it, a lot of sex talk, a lot of, for the time, really realistic sex talk. And I believe it had the best Phoebe Cates performance of all time. People still talk
most,
about it.
The most famous one, for sure.
Yeah, like right before she did Gremlins.
Yeah.
But you see, and in fact, it even ends the same way as Fast. Mallrats actually ends the exact, has the exact same ending as Fast Times. And, by the way, the same exact ending as, what was the George Lucas movie we were talking about?
American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. Sorry, I can't remember that for some reason.
Yeah.
Where you have the epitaphs, where they say such and such ended up here and did this.
Yeah, like that. Mm-hmm.
And it had the same kind of soundtrack. And I believe maybe that's what the studio thought they were trying to get with this. They could, because after Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Ethan, they produced so many clones, so many bad inferior versions, like Valley Girl, for example. Like Valley Girl is terrible. Did you see Valley Girl?
No, I have not seen Valley Girl, but I've seen Fast Times.
Yeah, Valley Girl is interesting because the best scenes in the movie are take place outside the ball.
Okay.
And I think it's Nicolas Cage's first big movie, but he does the whole thing with this nasal accent that it just ruins it. He's like, "Hey, how you doing? I'm Nicolas Cage. I'm not crazy yet." But they built him as some handsome devil, and he was back then. Nicolas Cage used to look really cool before he went nuts. But no, I think that's what Mallrats is aiming to be, and I think Kevin Smith would probably agree.
And if it was made now, this would have been a really good movie, I think, especially if they really tried to replicate the aesthetic, you know, the greens and pinks and neons and bright colors. And
it
stuff.
Is. It's very, very, very bright, by the way. We saw a little bit of that in Wonder Woman 1984 at the beginning with the mall scene. So, it's a mall because there's an arcade.
That's true. And Kevin Smith has been talking for years about doing some sort of sequel to Mallrats. And I think the tendency would be to see like, these characters, you know, 20 something years later. But I think if he wants to do it right, I think he should do it set back in the 90s again. I think that would be the way to do it if he does decide to go that route.
They did announce he's working on it. He called it Mallrats 2 Twilight of the Mallrats.
Yeah, he wrote the script, I guess, right?
By the way, you know, I was talking to a friend. Did I mention this on the last podcast when we talked about Roger Rabbit? That one of my favorite live-action animated movies is actually called Twilight of the Cockroaches?
Yeah, you mentioned that one.
Yeah, so I wonder. I think he's listening.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith, if you're listening, I'm so sorry I called you a dweeb. But come on, man. Make this movie. In Jay and Silent Bob Strike, the reboot, I believe some of these characters are in the movie.
Okay.
I have to go back and watch it, but it's quite honestly the worst thing he's ever done.
Hmm.
It's really bad. And And I think even Kevin Smith fans would agree this movie was probably a mistake.
Worse than Yoga Hosiers?
Yeah, I think worse than Yoga Hosiers, because I think he's trying to do that thing where he's trying to disassociate himself, knowing that it's one of those things where the characters become meta. Have you did you see the new Coming to America movie?
Yeah.
Okay, not very good.
Not
terrible. Got its moments.
The original one's not great either.
Oh no! Go to hell. Get out of here.
It's definitely worse than the original.
Okay, I'll just say this. Full disclosure, I'm not unbiased. It's my favorite Eddie Murphy movie by a long shot.
No way, really?
Oh, yeah, wow. It really is. But here's the thing. The second movie has moments of greatness in it, but unfortunately it's sandwiched between hackiness. And there's a scene in the movie where the characters do this thing where they talk about how bad sequels usually are, unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, and you see this a lot. It's not as meta as they think it is, because so many movies do this.
Yeah.
And Jay and Silent Bob's reboot does that. He's like, oh, this is an unnecessary reboot. This is unnecessary. It's like, I get it, you're saying it, but you're still making it. So
yeah, it's not like Scream where the whole movie revolves around this meta
thing. Well, I got a final thought on that whole situation. So in 2016, Netflix, they came out with a movie called On the Road with Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
They did not advertise it. They did not tell you what it was. But it is a sequel to The Office. It's it's his character from The Office, David Brent.
Huh.
It is not saying there's nothing associated with The Office. It's not saying The Office, David Brent's on the road. You have to figure it out. And when you realize it, you're like, oh wow, it's its own creature. And that's kind of what that I think Kevin Smith should have done with this, is that he should have done something so original, so distant, that it could stand on its own instead of just band-aiding it to the old thing.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. It's terrible. You know it's terrible. I know it's terrible. This movie's Kickstarter, whatever. But at the same point, though, meta only works if it's clever. You can't just... And I think a lot of his humor... The reason I don't like a lot of his humor, Ethan, is because I think he thinks by noticing something, you're supposed to think he's clever.
Yeah, well, and that's Clerks, too, right? It's just everything is just these overly astute observations and rants about things that he noticed. And,
well,
yeah.
I have a clip from Mallrats. I think you're going to like this clip. So this is probably one of the most famous scenes. This scene has been parroted so much by people who feel they've tried to intellectualize comic books. And would you agree that nobody has made comic books seem more intellectual than either Quentin Tarantino or Kevin Smith? But I'll be honest with you, I think Kevin Smith did it first. So here's a scene from Mallrats. You're going to like it. Ready?
They're engaged.
Doesn't matter. It can't happen.
Why not? It's bound to come up.
It's impossible. Lois could never have Superman's baby. Do you think her fallopian tubes could handle the sperm? I guarantee he blows a load like a shotgun right through her back. What about her womb? Do you think it's strong enough to carry his child?
Sure, why not?
He's an alien, for Christ's sake. His Kryptonian biological makeup is enhanced by Earth's yellow sun. If Lois gets a tan, the kid could kick right through her stomach. Only someone like Wonder Woman has a strong enough uterus to carry his kid. The only way he could bang regular chicks is with a kryptonite condom. That would kill him.
How's it I go from the verge of hot Floridian sex with Brandy to man of still coital debates with you in the food court?
Cookistan is not part of the food court.
Well, of course it is.
The food court is downstairs. The cookie stand is upstairs. It's not like we're talking quantum physics here.
The cookie stand counts as an eatery. The eateries are part of the food court.
Bullshit. Eateries that operate within the designated square downstairs qualify as food court. Anything outside of said designated square is considered an autonomous unit for mid-mall snacking. Now, if you're going to wax intellectual about the subject, holy shit.
So, you know,
I mean,
yeah.
That's so, yeah. I mean, that's just Jason Lee's so good in this.
He's so good, and the other guy is so bad.
Yeah.
And you know, this is my problem with this film. Is that it's so badly miscast that when you hear this other character, and I keep forgetting his name, but I think for
Jeremy
good reason.
London.
Yeah, Jeremy London. When you hear him just spout the dialogue, there's no beats between the dialogue. He's just saying it to say it.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't understand the dialogue.
Yeah.
And he's not the worst thing in this film. There's something else worse. But you just listen to these two, and you're listening to two different films. And Jason Lee is so funny in this. He's just so funny. Well, he's so good.
you put Jason Lee as Brody right next to Jeff Anderson, who played Randall in Clerks,
mm-hmm.
and that's when you really are seeing the difference. There's an actual emotion and understanding of the dialogue that Jason Lee has. Randall's not terrible, but he's also just kind of just like, like he's just kind of saying everything as though it's very like didactic instead of actually saying it like he's passionate about it.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But the characters have to have to be saying dialogue that feels natural to the character.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my favorite Pixar performances of all time is Jason Lee as Syndrome in The Incredibles.
Oh, yeah. I forgot he played that. Yeah.
He's so good in that movie. He fits so well in that universe. And to be fair, though, everybody fits in that universe. Like, Pixar's – I don't think any movie studio has ever casted voice talent better than Pixar. I think that's what they do. But yeah, in this film, like I said, I think watching it again now, I liked it better than I did before. I actually like it quite a bit more. But the problem though is the bad scenes are so bad. But I do have one more clip from Mallrats, and I apologize for those people who love or hate this movie. But I think nothing in this film demonstrates why this film is so disjointed and controversial for people in this particular scene. So I just want to set it up. And this is my last clip. This is the scene when Brody tries to get with his old girlfriend, Renee, a.k.a. Shannon Doherty. And just like the scene we just saw, or excuse me, we heard, Jason Lee's so good with his dialogue. But I think Shannon Doherty gives the worst performance in any Kevin Smith movie in this scene. You want to hear it? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the scene. I just call it the elevator scene. So if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about.
Jesus Christ!
What the hell gives it the cover, boy?
None of your damn business, but he'll probably kick your ass if he knows what you just pulled.
Are you insane? The guy looks like a date rapist! Is that my jacket?
Brody, start the elevator.
No, not until you tell me what the situation is with you and the Sperminator out there! How long has this been going on?
Since I finally mustered the good sense to send you packing. He's a much more suitable companion than you any day.
Are you nuts?! The guy's pure testosterone. He's a walking hard-on just looking for
a hole. I'm in need of testosterone after a year of babysitting you and your comic book collection. I forgot what real men were like.
I can't believe you had the nerve to come to my mall and pick up guys.
Oh, no. Shannon did the picking up. He's already taken me lunch at the cheese house, purchased tickets for the opera night, and brought me shopping to stores I want to shop in.
I took you shopping all the time.
You took me while you went shopping, you jerk. Do you think I care what rat hole store in that shit pit you call the Dermod's that latest Godzilla bootlegs? Do you caught eating pizza in the same dive pizzeria every night eating out? And do I give a shit what two major comic labels are crossing over characters selling two editions of the book and varying chromium covers? I'm a girl, damn it! I want to do girly things like fix it someone's hair and get phone calls expressing romantic sentiments!
I call you all the time!
Renee, my mom's asleep. Come over. You call that romantic? When was the last time you pulled out my chair or told me I was beautiful?
And this guy does all this in the span of a day.
This guy already introduced me to his mother.
Really?
Look, he was up and at work by 9 o'clock this morning. Unlike my ex-boyfriend, who would sleep until 1 because all he did was play Sega and watch videos all night long. Which, by the way, has enormous effect on your libido.
Oh, now you attack my libido?
There's no libido to attack.
No libido to attack?
Okay. You can't hear half of what she's saying.
Yeah, and that's all might even speak more to the dialogue.
Yeah.
Too. It's like she had such a hard time memorizing it, maybe, that she was just trying to get it out as fast as possible.
Well,
that's what I think.
I heard this friend who used to have this theory that bad actors are the ones who read bad dialogue and they don't do anything about it. Whereas good actors insist. Yeah, like there's this theory that if you close your eyes and you listen, you can hear bad acting, right?
Yeah.
Like it's pretty common. But when you listen to something like this, it's poor dialogue delivered poorly by a poor actress.
Yeah.
And it's the trifecta of poor. It's really bad. It's really bad. But you listen to Jason Lee, and he's having a completely different conversation. With the same dialogue. And he knows when to modulate his voice. He knows how to talk. He knows how to do things. He can remote. She's just breathlessly, you could hear her losing her breath, trying to get this shit out. And it doesn't work. At all. Nothing she says sounds convincing. In fact, it sounds like, I don't know, local theater, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, he's totally. A much more suitable companion for me anyway, and Sega! And it's just, no. Like I said, I want to like this movie more, but the problems that I have, I just think they're just systemic to the film itself. And I think for all the times that I enjoy it, there's moments like this where I can't root for some of these characters because it's just so awful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a big part of why I like it is just the milieu and, mm-hmm. and Jason Lee and just maybe even the promise of a better movie. Cause I still like watching this movie. I've seen it a few times mm-hmm. and I enjoy it every time I watch it. I think I just love watching. It's kind of a guilty pleasure. I'm a really big mall freak, like mm-hmm. Jason Lee in this movie, and I think I just attach to it. Like, I am the kind of guy who just on an off day just want to go to the mall and walk around and not buy anything. I love
that's true.
You ask my wife, I dream about malls more than I dream about anything else. Like at night.
I will give this movie credit though. For all its faults, it does feel like of the time. Like it does feel authentic about going to the mall and hanging out. And just having fun. And I maintain, Ethan, that if he had just focused more on that and just sort of the nonsense, like the nonsensical sequiturs that happen in the mall, I think we would have had a much better movie. But I feel also that this is a necessary mistake, because I do believe that the next movie Kevin Smith made, Chasing Amy, was so vastly superior in every way. I think the cast is so much better. Like, the cast is, like, there's, I don't think there's any sour notes in the cast in the next movie.
Jason Lee's in that movie, too?
Yeah, he's awesome in the movie. And Ben Affleck is much, much better. You can see why he became a megastar. I believe, like you said, Matt Damon's only in for a minute, but it's a crucial minute. And I think Joey Lauren Adams is awesome as Gwen, as her character. But I want to say one more thing about Mallrats, and this is the connector piece. You ready? I want to talk about Sven Ole Thorsen for a second. So Sven is actually a main character in this film, but I don't think he talks, does he?
No.
He plays the mall security guard, the foil that does everything. Are you familiar with Sven?
No, I don't really know a lot about him. I was looking up. I've seen a couple of his movies, I think.
Okay, let me just read you some of his movie credits. You ready?
Yeah.
Conan the Barbarian, Conan the Destroyer, Red Sonja, Raw Deal, Lethal Weapon, Predator, The Running Man, Red Heat, Twins, Ghostbusters 2, Total Recall, Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe, Terminator 2, Death Becomes Her, Lethal Weapon 3, Cyborg 2, Dragon, The Bruce Lee Story, Last Action Hero, Hard Target, and it goes on.
You just can read from his filmography. You can you don't even have to know what this guy looks like, and you can create like a character sketch in your head.
and that's all before Mallrats. And then after that, he just keeps going. He's a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he's been many characters. Although I think his starring role is I think his best movie ever is probably Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe. Have you seen Abraxas?
No.
Okay, he plays the main bad guy. Let me see real quick. By the way, speaking of shared universes, so Abraxas, Guardians of the Universe. I don't want to talk about this film. It's not a very good film, but it stars Jesse Ventura as Abraxas, and it stars Sven as Secundus. And let's just say this. You ready for this? There is a shared universe because they pipe in another character. They pipe in James Belushi from another film that he was in. He played the principal. What was it? What was that movie he was in? Oh goodness, I want to get you the name real quick. Give me one second here. What movie was it? Wasn't Mr. Destiny? Was it? But no. So you have another movie with a shared universe with a completely contrasting character. But Abraxas is terrible. But it's fun because it's terrible. Huh. And Sven's pretty good. So good job, Sven. By the way, he's ripped in this movie.
Yeah. You can never see it, but yeah, he's pretty ripped.
No, at the end he has his shirt off.
Oh, that's right. Was that the book signing?
Can I say this? Let's just say that he has his shirt off before he sleeps with a 15-year-old girl, which is played for laughs.
Oh, man, and there was supposed to be. There's a lot of deleted scenes that he took out of this movie. That kind of one of them, I think, had to do with that too.
Yeah, I think – you know what? I think the version I watched is probably the uncut version, which you got to be careful with sometimes because sometimes there's a reason why they take out scenes. But I think the last time they actually had a movie that dealt so cavalierly with underage sex was probably a Woody Allen movie.
Like Harold and Maude, too.
Harold and Maude is weird.
Oh, he's not underage, I guess.
No, he's not underage, but she's way overage. Yeah. But no – What was the movie? The one where, goodness, the one with the bridge. Is it Manhattan? She played like a 15-year-old in that movie.
Maybe.
I forget. But we all
haven't seen them. He has so many movies I've seen maybe like.
Let's not talk about Woody Allen underage women, if we could avoid that. So that's Mallrats, 1995, a movie you and I are split on, but I think it has its charms, and I think it's I think there's a better movie inside of it, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen. But the other movie you picked out was, on the surface, radically different, and that was last year's 2020, Jasper Maul, directed by Bradford Tom. Is it Thomason or Thomason and Brett McComb?
I think it's Thomason. Yeah.
You know what? Get a real name, Bradford. Pick a name. Thomason. Debuted on Amazon Prime, which I mentioned might be a little ironic, considering Amazon is the unintended target about why these malls are closing down, so to speak.
Yes, it is kind of funny. Yeah.
But you love this movie, and for those who don't know, Ethan is – I'll just say it, Ethan. You're the biggest supporter of this film in the world.
Yeah, I think I'm the leading rallier for
You totally are. You've promoted this film more than the directors have, more than Amazon has.
Yeah, probably, definitely more than Amazon has. It's kind of sad, but I just love this movie. It's so good. I really love this movie.
Well,
I adore it, I should say.
I'm surprised we didn't really talk about this movie more when we talked about one of our first podcast episodes, which was Nomadland. Which, by the way, still think is going to win Best Picture, still think is going to win Best Actress. So if I'm right, then I'm playing the lottery. Jasper Maul. So tell us a little bit about what Jasper Maul is about.
Yeah, sure. It's a documentary, first let's start with that. And it just shows a dying mall, shopping mall in Jasper, Alabama. Mall first opened 1981, and it now has 15 stores, I believe, in it.
81 or 82?
The guy says 82 at one point, but I looked it up online and it was 81.
Are you talking are we talking about the main character in the movie?
No, the jeweler says 82 at one point.
Okay.
But they were looking at the opening day photograph and that was dated 81. So
okay.
When they were looking at that. But so it opened 1981, now has 15 stores, I believe, in it. They out of the anchor stores, I think they maybe have like one anchor store left. This place is like People are. I don't even know how it's even still surviving. It's still
open, by the way, which we'll get into.
Still open today, yeah.
Yeah, doing better actually.
This movie probably helped it a little bit. Hopefully.
Probably.
And it's just about the people who work there, people who quote unquote shop there or hang out there, the mall rats. People kind of like the Jason Lee characters who just love going to the mall and just hanging out. And it kind of juxtaposes, it doesn't show any clips from back in the day. It shows some photographs,
exactly.
But you feel the history, I think, in a way, and you feel it through these newer characters or these newer people who talk about what it was like back in the day. And even some younger teenagers who are kind of having their own new memories at the mall, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. I think the concept here is to sort of not only show that sort of what would have been like the salad days of this mall, the closing days, but still show that how new people were joining the family. And we see several characters who are much younger working there. We see one young guy. This is a job for him. I believe maybe his first job. They don't really make a big deal about it though.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about Jasper Maul. So real quick, before we go on, can you see my screen? I'm sharing my screen with Ethan. Can you see this?
Yeah. I can see it.
Okay, I want you to look at this area because I'm going to come back to this in a second. Because I have an issue with this movie that I think is critical, that I think we need to address in the film. So the movie came out in 2020. Chronologically speaking, that is right before the pandemic hit, closed down a lot of businesses.
Yeah.
So I think the intention of this movie was to show, tell me if I'm right or wrong, to not only show the sort of the passing by of these ancient relics, these centers of capitalism, but to show like a dwindling economic downturn, the same way Nomadland did. If you think about it, this movie has a lot more in common with Nomadland than a lot of movies we've talked about.
Yeah,
it's beautifully shot. It deals with real characters like Nomadland. It's gorgeous to look at, and it's very melancholic, I believe.
Yeah. It's kind of similar also in tone to a Ghost Box Cowboy too, which is kind of funny.
A little bit, yeah. I noticed a few scenes. And, well, I told you, I paired Ghost Box Cowboy with Nomadland because I think the underlying message was sort of the desolation of the American landscape and, like, sure, the dwindling influence of commerce and capitalism. And whereas Nomadland was almost a direct assault on Amazon, this movie never mentions Amazon at all. And so I wonder if commentary was removed or if it was ever recorded, because we don't really know a lot about anybody in this movie, Ethan. That's the problem.
Yeah. Except for the main guy.
Okay, let's talk about him for a second, because he's the guy that is most likely the character. His name is Mike McClelland.
Yeah.
And I think had this movie been edited differently, this could have been a very different movie. Let's talk about Mike McClelland, because just like Claire Florani on Mallrats, what the hell accent does he have?
I think he's from Australia, and then he's been in Alabama for a long time, so I think he just has a really effed up accent.
Okay, he's got two accents though.
Yeah, he does switch back and forth. And I know a couple people like this who have lived in two different places and two different strong accents. And they kind of fluctuate between the two, and he really does that sometimes. I didn't even notice the overseas stuff until maybe halfway through, and I was like, "Oh wait, he's got something else going on there."
Yeah, let's listen to his accent real quick, because I think it does sort of set the stage for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
So I got two clips here of him talking. The first clip is let's listen. This is Mike talking about pooping. Here we go. Pooping clip. Here we go.
You guys have. You have no idea. I hate to say it, but I don't know what it is, but we've had all kinds, but I mean, we've had people poop in the middle of the floor in the bathroom, in the urinal, you know, and I don't see how, I guess it's just meanness, you know? I don't see how they can miss a toilet that big and hit it in the floor, you know? But we've had all, I mean.
Okay. And I have another clip where we hear a little bit more about his character, which we can get into in a second, because I do think it has to do with the documentary. Here's another clip, and you listen to his accent, and the reason I bring this up is because, well, I'll explain after we get this clip. Here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go, second clip.
I owned a zoo for 25 years. Lions, tigers. Yeah, you probably see that's my passion. I've been in the hospital 22 times, and I went in the pen with everything. They were my kids, and my wife said, look, she would just increase the life insurance policy on me. And she said, listen, you know, you might want to slow down. But boom, ripped that tendon and nerve out for me. Yeah, buffalo homie right there, mountain lion right there, just, you know, normal stuff.
Yeah, you would never think that's the same guy just listening. It sounds completely different. Because he does have a story. It's very similar to another show that came out on Netflix in 2020 that took the world by storm, which was their show Tiger King.
Yep.
With Joe Exotic. And much like Joe Exotic, Mike McClelland is also in his late 40s, early 50s, also has bleached blonde hair, also ran a zoo that was shut down by PETA, also had a penchant for tigers, and also had a shady past. Mike McClelland, he ran a zoo called McClelland's Critters that was shut down for animal abuse. And I included a notice about that in the notes here. You can look at from PETA, of all places. But the problem is that when you're following this documentary, you want to follow these characters down. You see all these interesting things. The movie never follows any of it because I don't think they're the focus. I think the focus is the mall. Mm-hmm. And there were two characters that stood out to me most of all. And like you mentioned, like the documentary, they follow this for, was it a year?
Yeah, it
okay,
was a year.
2018, 2019, right? Yep. So they follow these characters, but some of the characters I don't know why they followed, and I want your opinion on this. The two characters that they followed were the mixed-race couple. I say characters, but it was really the white girl and her black boyfriend who were teenagers. Yep. And she talks about how she's going to do this and that. They met on Instagram. And then there was another person. He was clearly gay, the gay teenager or the 20-year-old, and he was talking about how he was being sexually harassed by some of the older men.
Yeah.
And we never see anything about him again, ever.
That is – okay, so this movie, there are two scenes I've seen this movie twice now. Mm-hmm. And both times I'm like – I'm really trying to draw why they're talking about this person, and he's one of them. And the other one is when they show the couple, the military training.
Oh, you mean
those are the two that I'm like, they're so randomly placed in this movie, and they, because all the other stuff I can connect. I'm like, okay, I can see why they put that in there. I can, it's connecting to this nostalgia. Those are the two where both times I watch it, the military one's hilarious. By the
yeah,
way,
yeah, I don't. I'm glad you mentioned
that. That's why they put it in.
So to set it up, there's these two people. There's this very large, obese man, and this younger woman, and who's very fit. And for some reason, the drill instructors decided to test their physical fitness inside the mall. Which, by the way, feels so scripted to me. And he moves the furniture out of the way, and they're trying to do these sit-ups and push-ups and running. And the fat man just can't do anything. He eventually has to sit it out. Where the girl, who doesn't make a sound, you could tell she doesn't want to be filmed. Yeah. Smokes him, and yeah. Smokes him.
He's having such a hard time. It reminded me of basketball tryouts in high school. I'm just like leaning against the wall, like, oh, geez.
I was like, what did you think was going to happen? What did you think was going to happen? But yeah, we never see anything about that again. Nothing. No follow up. No talk. We're never introduced to the drill instructor. Yeah. It just plops in, and I would have liked to see some context about something.
Yeah.
And there's no context.
That and the younger, the teenager, those are the two things that I felt had no context. The drill instructor thing, I think, was just maybe for comedy
filler.
And just like a funny moment. The other one was just kind of, it was really weird. And it talked about how his view of the town a little bit and how he views Jasper and how he doesn't hate it there, but he still just rather be anywhere else. He always likes to travel and stuff, I guess. But
well, we never know anything about Jasper, and I think maybe the filmmakers, who are not natural Alabamans, they're from Texas, I felt like they were searching for vestiges of racism and prejudice, because when you think of southern towns, like we talked about this in the movie Minority, which I also think took place in Alabama or Arkansas in the 1980s. Yeah. And you and I were both surprised that the movie does not focus. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Like, they never really experience racism. And that it felt so refreshing, because we both have – I know you and I both have friends who are from the South. We've talked about this. And the idea that everybody in the South is racist is absurd.
Yeah.
And I know people still experience racism. They still experience homophobia, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
But that is so much not the norm. Specifically now, and I think maybe the filmmakers were trying to find instances of diversity, because I looked up the statistics of Jasper, and you think to yourself, you hear Alabama, well, it's got to be integrated because of the South. Jasper is very white.
Yeah.
It's very white. It's about 40 minutes north of Birmingham, but it's very white, and you really don't see a lot of different races. I don't think you see any Asians. You see just a spattering of Black Americans.
Yeah, the nail lady was at the end was Asian.
Oh, is she? Like you caught better than I did. And
I've seen
like,
it twice now.
But you see what I'm saying, though? It's like you look at this and you're like, it seems like they're like the story of this couple that found themselves on Instagram. Like it could have been a commentary on something else, but it said like, let's focus on racism. Yeah. But it doesn't. But it's like, oh, my family's okay with it. It's okay with it. It's like they're filming the movie Loving from 1969. Like, no, you're in 2000 America. Like, there's really no problem with it. And I would have liked to see more of this guy who said he was harassed by these older perverts, because it's set up at the beginning when you show Mike said he's letting in the homeless people and he's letting in the old people to walk around. And they set up this character. They set these characters up, the old guy in the wheelchair with the oxygen, who, by the way, passed away in the movie. And it's like, are we going to follow these characters? Are we going to see, like, cause and effect? But nothing is ever done with anything. We never see any of these characters outside of these scenes. And I don't know about you, but I don't hate it. But I kind of would have liked to see a little follow-up. I would have liked to see something, just something. But I don't know. So, I mean, how do you feel about it?
I loved it. I think it's so cool because, for me, it's – I think – if you view it as kind of the mall is the surrogate for the audience, then you're not really going to see anything that the mall doesn't see. And I think it's perfect in that instance when they show the carnival and you're in the carnival for 5-10 minutes and it's cool. It looks beautiful. And then at the very end, the carnival's still going on and they just cut to inside the mall and there's nobody in the mall and it's looking out at the carnival through the doors, the glass doors of the mall, and it's just quiet in the mall and the carnival, everyone's outside. When this carnival is there to bring people into the mall, And it's probably not even really doing that. For me, the mall is the perspective. And I think that was really what the directors were trying to do and try to show everything you know was from inside these walls or, you know, in the premises.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think they probably made the right choice. And I think maybe my frustrations at wanting to follow these characters would have probably detracted from the point they were trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think had you gone a different way with this Mike McClellan guy, you would have had Tiger King.
Yeah.
Totally. You know, you would have had, yeah. If you followed the gay employee, you would have had something else. You would, like, every one of these characters, it's sort of like Dorothy following. You ever notice in The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy has to follow the Red Brick Road? You ever notice there's another road there, but we never follow? Like, if you follow that Red Brick Road, then you're not going to Oz. You're going somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I think...
Yeah. I wish Dorothy followed that road, yeah.
I know. You ever see that, though? Like, you ever think, like, oh, that... Like, where would that road lead us?
Yeah.
Interesting. But no, but what I mean, though, is that – so it's frustrating to me on a narrative perspective, but maybe I'm willing to admit that that's just my own issues with narrative, because I think we see these documentaries so much that are not really documentaries, that are propaganda masquerading as documentaries, and we sort of get hooked on the whole idea that there has to be a thoroughput, there has to be a narrative. And so as crazy as Michael McClellan sounds, I think there's a story there where he's not being honest about it. And he's revealing this at the end when he's saying, oh, the owner of this mall owns 30 other malls. I'll be okay. Or 300 malls, I think, or whatever he says.
30, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know.
It's crazy.
Exactly. But, you know, you can see where that could have gone. We could have followed him somewhere else. And the mall would have just been a background character in its own movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, you mentioned the carnival, though. So you mentioned this reminded you of Ghostbucks Cowboy. Me too.
Yeah.
The scene when – so you have one of the women who works – does she work at the nail salon or where does she work?
Oh, it's the hair
– Yeah, the hair place. The
hairdresser, yeah. I really – this was a big moment for me. When she's talking outside, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, when she's talking to her friend about like, oh, go to New York. We can live there. Yeah. It's a bigger life and have kids. I didn't know she had a kid. And so she has a daughter and I hated this scene. Because
which one?
The scene
at the
when
carnival?
The scene no the scene in the carnival when she's making her daughter.
Oh yeah.
I felt so terrible, but it made me think, right? So she's putting her daughter on this merry-go-round. And the daughter's really cute. She's laughing. Oh, that's so funny. But it's clear the daughter doesn't want to go on the merry-go-round, but the mother's making her do it.
Yeah.
And then the mother as her daughter's screaming, she's laughing and she keeps saying, "You want it so bad." And the daughter's screaming. But the mother is imposing the merry-go-round on the daughter at this point. The daughter does not want to be on that damn horse.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a scene a little later, which we haven't talked about yet, but with the mall Santa. And by the way, I don't want to see a naked mall Santa ever. I saw too much of this guy's boobs. I don't want to see this. Did you see that? It's gross.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They showed him shirtless.
Yeah, they showed Santa shirtless.
Santa.
Shirtless Santa, and they showed this Santa at the mall, and you see these kids show up, and the kids, he's like, "What do you want?" He's like, "What do you want for Christmas?" And the kids are like, "I want this, I want this, and I want this." And the girl's like, "I want this," and they're just rattling off what they want, right?
Yeah.
And it made me realize how much like the mall Santa is all part of it's all part of the mall ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like I never really thought about it because when I was a kid, did you ever go to a mall Santa when you were a kid? Did they still have those?
I've taken my own son there.
See, you're part of the – see? Exactly. You're that mother. You want this so bad.
He likes Santa.
Well, do you remember the scene in The Christmas Story when the kids are screaming with Santa?
Yeah, he pushes him down.
Yeah, he's like, ho, ho, ho. But so my earliest memory of Santa for myself was I was at this mall, and I have some mall stories. But there was this – they used to have this service, Ethan, called Video Santa. Do you remember these?
No.
And you would – this was a novelty back in the 80s. That's how old I am. But you'd sit on Santa's lap, and they would record you on VHS tape, right? And my mom still has this tape of me sitting on Santa's lap. I had just turned 8 years old that day. And Santa's like, "Well, what do you want for Christmas, little boy?" And I said, "I want Atari tapes. I want Atari tapes. I want it." Like, "Oh, Atari." And Santa had no damn clue what Atari tape was. But he just promised me I'd get them. And I did, because my mom was cool, and she found some at a flea market. And but no, that's my Video Santa. I had no problem with Santa. That's the trade, man. I'll sit on his lap.
Yeah.
You know, I'll want my Atari tapes.
I think it's also for the parents, right, to hear what your kids want so they know what to get you.
Exactly. And so now you've promised, you've manipulated your child into thinking this holy elf is going to give them what they want. So now you have to get what they want.
Yeah.
And where are you going to get it? That's right. At the mall. Because you're right there. It all perpetuates. It's like a virus. Santa's a virus.
Yeah. Hopefully these 15 stores in the mall, three of them are hairdressers.
What do you want for Christmas?
Whatever
I want
this
perm.
Little boy's asking for.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like a gift certificate to get some flowers? No, there's no food court even, is there? But
yeah, there's two restaurants.
No, but it's true, though. You know, it's true that you have this – and I thought the scene with the screaming mother – excuse me, screaming daughter was Ghostbox Cowboy, because you remember there's that scene when the mother is doing the indoor sky jump.
Yeah,
and you just
that's
see,
right.
And the baby's just sitting there just oblivious as the mother is just doing this useless thing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what do we want? Like, how much stuff can you have? Like, what do you want?
Yeah.
It's all about what I want. And what a perfect delivery system the mall was.
It's like and seeing it now, it's like this cry for help from you know, retail stores, but all they can provide is a mall Santa who's just gonna have these parents buy things on the internet.
Yep.
It's like it's just almost self-sabotage at this point.
Well, you feel it too, though. I mean, you feel like as the season goes by, and again, the movie doesn't do a very good job of documenting the time flow, but you do see the Christmas scene. I mean, a lot of malls had the Easter Bunny. You know, they would have their sets, they would have their costumes, and we would dress the mall up for the season because we want you to feel the changing of the season. Now, you're in California where you don't really have snow. But in the Midwest, you don't need to be told it's Christmas. You know, I can't drive my car because there's 10 feet of ice. But like, but we need Santa. But no, I mean, I think – I don't know if the filmmakers were trying to explicitly or implicitly talk about this dynamic breakdown. But like you have these children saying, I want this, I want this. But meanwhile, the infrastructure's crumbling. Like you said, there's some hairdressers.
Yeah,
and there's a jewelry repair shop who's about to be gone,
and the hair salons is closing too. And the subway. We see the different. I think that's how they kind of mark the time passing is by different stores closing. You're like, okay, it's been a few months.
Well, who was the main one? It was the girl. It was the woman with the flower shop.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Robin's Nest.
Yeah, Robin's Nest. Who had been there? She had been there since 1989.
Yeah, and she was just retiring. She wasn't. It had nothing to do with no business. Like she was doing. She was the only, one of the only businesses there that was actually getting customers.
Yeah, she was, and she had to turn people away.
Yeah.
But I think they never really say what her age was, but they kind of hint at it when she talks to that mother who's like 55.
Yeah.
And she's like, "You're too young," and she's got a 30-year-old. So yeah. I think she was probably in her 70s, maybe 80s.
Yeah. But there's a really, really quick scene, you blink, you'll miss it, of the girl, there's a little girl playing a claw machine.
Mm-hmm. I saw that,
It's really quick. She just goes down, and obviously the claw machine, this happens 9 times out of 10. It goes down, and it grabs something, and comes up, and it's empty. And it's like, boom, that's it. Like, that's, that. It's such a microcosm of just everything. It's like... This mall needs your money, but they have very little to offer you.
And that's what I want to get at next. I asked you if you could see my screen, right? So one thing the movie doesn't actually tackle, but you and I will tackle, is that I think it wants to give you the impression that the economy itself is the reason why the mall is closing down.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. And this poor southern town, again, 40 minutes from Birmingham, but... I went on Google Maps, right, and I looked it up, and I don't know if you can see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Jasper's not doing too bad. In fact, they're doing pretty good. And if you look at the number of stores, like, can you see where the mall is right here?
Mm-hmm.
And like within 5 minutes, you can go to Walgreens. You can go to there's a Walmart Supercenter. There's TJ Maxx, Hobby Lobby. There's like 24 really nice fancy restaurants. You know, there's even other outdoor shopping malls. There's multiple parking. Outdoor shopping malls. Multiple entire discount chains. All this stuff within 5 minutes from the mall. This is why the mall is going out of business.
Yeah.
This is why the mall, not because of necessarily the economy suffering, But
well, the jeweler talks about it, right? He says, yesterday I made $16 the whole day. Today, or, you know, the other day I made $20. He's like, I just can't do it. He says, but if I moved my shop just to some, like a standalone in town, I'd be doing fine. It would fix the problem. He's literally just staying in this mall because he has an emotional connection to the mall. Maybe he's nostalgic. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Maybe he doesn't really need the money necessarily, but you know, it is just the infrastructure of the mall itself.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
That is why people aren't going there, because it's like, okay, I got to park in this massive parking lot.
Yes.
I have to walk a mile to get to the store. Like, why am I going to do that if I can just drive up, boom, walk in, walk out?
Well, you look at this, and a lot of this stuff, if you look online, if you go to Street View, a lot of these infrastructures look relatively recent, maybe within the last 10 years. And so the idea of the mall as this as this delivery system for this entire sort of capitalistic synergy, and that's what it was always designed to be. You know, it's a very science fiction-y kind of way of looking at capitalism. And I'm pro-capitalist, by the way. Let's make no mistake. I'm all about the money. And I was looking it up, and the guy who invented the concept of it was Victor Gruen. Mm-hmm. And if you look up his history. If you go look at his idea, this whole idea around central planning, it's very much of the time. The idea that you would go there and you would have access to everything. And this is at a time when it was very difficult to build a new building. It was they didn't have the ability to throw up new stores on a whim like they do now, like these McMansion type houses. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, a good crew can build a Dairy Queen in a week if they want to, you know. But back in the day, that didn't happen. And so I think what happened is let me ask you a question. Are you in your 30s yet?
Oh, yeah, 32.
Oh, 32. Yeah, you're so young. But when I was a kid, here's how it went. You went to the mall, you got dropped off, or you rode your bike there, or you walked there, and you spent the day there because it was safe. It provided an indoor shopping experience, of which you did very little shopping. But you met your friends. You went to the same stores you liked. You got to see everything. You got to have lunch. You weren't going to be molested, hopefully. And the idea is, you know, there was always supervision. It provided like 10 different services in one. Yeah. And later on, malls added movie theaters. They added toy stores. They added pet stores. They added video game stores. They added arcades. Stores. Yeah, it was a cornucopia. It was awesome. But as time went by, you know, I think we like to blame Amazon. We like to blame online shopping for destroying these stores. I've never felt that was the truth. Like, for example, I'm a book guy. I love bookstores. I've been a bookstore fan my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think Amazon or eBay destroyed the bookstores. What it was, though, is that bookstores never evolved. And the idea is that you get to keep your same store forever and you don't have to change. That's like saying cars put horse and buggies out of business, or the telephone put, you know, telegrams out of business. In some respect, they did, but you have to evolve your business.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you become niche. You become sort of a gimmick.
Well, let's look at Nintendo. Nintendo has been around for 150 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
They started as a playing card company.
Yes.
If they had stuck to playing cards, like, okay, they'd just still be selling playing cards, and like people still buy playing cards. But now there's dozens and dozens and dozens of other really big playing card companies. But instead, in the 80s or 70s, probably.
It was the 70s. Yeah. They saw it coming, and they made the switch. By the way, exactly. They still make playing cards. In fact, don't forget, who makes Pokemon?
Yeah.
So, but the fact in the by the way, the word for it is called Hanafuda. And just so you know, playing cards and love motels. That's it. That's Nintendo.
Yeah.
Love motels. So, Mario loves you. But no, you're exactly right, though. I mentioned Western Union. Western Union, you know, you look back at 1950s, 60s movies, telegram for Mr. and Mrs., Western Union, right?
Yeah.
But now they took that same service infrastructure and they transmogrified it into money delivery systems. It works.
Yeah.
They're still around. They make good money. They make really good money. A good company will do that. And by the way, there are a lot of local bookstores that have evolved. There's more local bookstores now than there were before Amazon.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But
it is hard to evolve if your main product doesn't evolve much, too.
Well, that's the other thing. If you think of the mall as the product, then the mall itself has growing pains. Like for example, if I want to start a store, do I start a store inside this mall where I have to dedicate myself and I have to be in direct competition, I have to abide by the mall's rate. It's like renting an apartment, you know, versus buying a house. Or do I go somewhere else? I mean, I've done small businesses myself, Ethan, but I can tell you right now, I don't think I would choose a mall, because I would have to look at the available. I would have to look at the foot traffic, because mm-hmm. on the street people can drive by and see my store. They can drive, or they can go on the internet and find me. But with a mall, you're just regulated to all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. And so, yeah. But yeah. So, what local malls do you have? Are there any local malls around you?
Oh man, so. In California, at least Southern California, where I live, there are probably maybe four malls within 15, 20 minutes of me.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you can go there on a Tuesday, and it's doing fine. Like, non-Christmas, non-any holiday season, these malls out here are doing perfectly fine. I don't know about in Alabama, apparently. Maybe it's not like that. I don't know about in Kansas, but
we have some malls. Malls are doing okay out here, too. So I have this weird experience with a mall, by the way. So I'm from the East Coast. I'm from New England. And so there was a mall that used to be one of my favorite places in the world. I'll say what it is. It's called the Mall of New Hampshire. If you're from New England, you know this mall. And I spent a lot of my childhood in that mall. I was the generic 80s kid. I love this mall. Orange Julius all day long. And I had not set foot in this mall in over 20 years. And when I went back about a year or so ago to look at it, it was weird because you have that sense of deja vu where you can like visually spatialize where everything should have been and how it's been shifted. And the mall still exists, but it's like this new form on it. Stores that in my mind where they should be are gone. Things are amenities that were used to be there are gone. But the mall still exists and it was doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't my mall anymore.
Yeah.
You know. But I can tell you in the interceding 20 years in the Midwest where there were not malls down every street, you know what replaced those malls, right? It was Walmart.
Yeah.
Especially the 24-hour Walmarts where you would go there at a certain time of day and the kids would be there. They would hang out at Walmarts.
Now, do you think that's a big – you think like Walmarts and Targets and this the big resurgence of those the last 20 years is a big reason why the malls aren't there? Because you can get everything at one place instead of going to one place and having to walk to a million different places?
Well, that's true. That's part of it. I think the other thing is malls are not expanding. I think the malls that we're talking about are the existing infrastructures that have sort of been rejiggered and, urban renewal, so to speak. Yeah. And, you know, they have this amazing infrastructure that can be repurposed as anything else. You see this a lot with old architecture. Like, again, I go to New England. We have old mill yards, which were built out of brick. And these things have been around for 200-300 years. They're not going to demolish them just because they're old and replace them with styrofoam. They repurpose them. They gut them out. The bones are still good, and they turn them into restaurants. You know, they turn them into restaurants. They turn them into colleges. They turn them into all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and what state was that in again?
New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yeah, they opened up high schools inside some of the old mall containers. You know what I mean? They repurposed the schools. You know, that's Jasper Mall, for example. There was a lot of good news after this movie came out, and this is the biggest problem I have with these movies: is that we're trying to write an epitaph on this mall. Like, by all intents and purposes, you're left with the impression this mall is done after this movie. But no, it's been re-energized. It's doing better than ever. Like, it's doing really well.
Yeah.
Like, but mostly because of churches that have moved in. Like, there was the nonprofits have moved in, some churches, and you kind of see that a little bit in the film, like with church revivals. And
mm-hmm.
but go figure. I mean, why not? Right? Why
not? I think too. In this day and age, the need to just hang out is kind of dwindling. People my age are not just interested in just going someplace and just hanging out. They want to do something. They want to, like, you know, hang out and play video games, hang out and watch a movie, hang out and do this, hang out and do that. And I think that the rise of that and just people also just kind of living in their own self-absorption, you know, on their phones and not really wanting to – people are a lot more home-bodied now than I think that they've ever been.
Well, do you remember – I came out and visited you a couple of years – like about a year ago, and you and I went mm-hmm. – took a road trip. And we went to that computer store to go buy some computer parts for you.
Yeah.
Micro Center. For all intents and purposes, that's just a little mini mall itself.
Yeah.
And I can tell you something. I've been to a few of these stores around the country, and it reminds me of two things. It reminds me of when movie theaters would show a new Star Wars film, and they'd open up at midnight. Or you'd have a new product, like a new game would come out, or a new video card would come out, and people would gather in line to wait, like Black Friday. So it seems like people are hungry for this sort of social participation when it comes to commerce. Like we see this with concerts. People queue up to go to the concert, or they cheer. They queue up to go to the, you know, the whatever game's playing. They queue up to buy stuff at midnight. They queue up to buy crap they don't need. They're just looking for a reason to go out of their house and do it.
Yeah.
And I think the mall was all those things at once. It was everything. You could go there in the one-stop shop. You got your socializing out of the way. You got your shopping out of the way. And I think one thing the pandemic has demonstrated very much is that I think when you look at the social scientists, the demographic people, they think, oh, everything, we're gonna work from home. It's going to be great. We're going to do school from home. It's going to be great. They had this stupid idea that human beings would transfer this ancient instinct to be social to online seamlessly. Yeah. And I think what the pandemic has shown us, what total bullshit that was, that people really want to be together. They really want. And they just need an excuse.
Yeah.
They just want an excuse. You know, it's like, I got to tell you, like, I get so lonely sometimes. I need a pencil. I'm going to get my car and drive all the way to Walmart to buy a pencil just so I can talk to somebody.
And people are breaking the rules now because of the pandemic to to be with other people. And I think it sucks in one regard, but it also is like kind of a good sign for where humanity, like, we actually miss people, like to where we're at the point where we actually miss people. Like, and I think maybe that's why a place like Jasper Mall might have a little resurgence now.
Yeah, I think so.
Because people, you know, because of this pandemic.
Well, exactly. And again, I mentioned churches, and churches have been a fantastic outlet for these people, especially not necessarily for the religious people, but it's a good way to communicate with your neighbors in a way that's respectful. Yeah. And, you go back to it, the original theory was that people were going to be so inspired by having unfettered contact with each other online. It was going to create this new utopia of imagination. And we were going to collaborate with each other online. We were going to create all this. No. But I think what's going to happen is that what happened after the last pandemic of 1919 or 1920, where we were so pent up being home and tired of actually dying, that if you look at what happened in the 1920s, the 1920s were an explosion of everything. We exploded intellectually. We exploded with just dancing and art and all this stuff. The 1920s were awesome for this stuff. And I think we may be looking at this resurgence where people just want to get the hell out of the house.
Yeah, the Renaissance happened after the dark period, the dark ages, you know.
Yep. It's the classic case of physics, you know, its potential energy turns into kinetic energy.
Yeah.
And I think that might happen again. You know, as we're talking about this, a movie that's about to be released in theaters at home, Godzilla vs. Kong, right? This movie, which nobody was looking forward to 6 months ago because the last movie apparently hadn't done very well, is breaking box office records already because people want to get out of the house. I'll see anything. But it's just, you know, I mean, it's like, what you got?
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's tempting to watch a movie like Jasper Mall and say, feel a little hopeless and be like, oh man, like a place like this can never be again. But I think that the filmmakers do a good job of showing the community and showing how, I mean, there's not as many people, but the community is still just as passionate about this mall and just as passionate about their community as maybe they've ever been. Like, the hustle and bustle is gone, but the enthusiasm, I think, is still there. And
I think
that people just still love that. You can tell people in the mall are in love with this mall.
You know, they never really go into it, but at the beginning when he talks about opening up early and you see the old people, like especially the guy with the oxygen, how certain people sort of depend on the mall to be their place. And you see vestiges of this. Like, you go to the right McDonald's early in the morning, you see the old-timers gather so they can get their coffee and just talk. Like, people just look for a reason to get together, right? And you see this. It doesn't matter necessarily where it is. It's the mall provides an easy access point. But do you know a lot of malls started – like, did I ever tell you I used to work in a mall?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I worked at a temp job in a mall years and years and years and years ago where I helped shepherd a dinosaur exhibit. And the only place we could get was like an old JCPenney. And we set up – it was a science museum I worked for. And we set up these large animatronic dinosaurs. And we needed an old JCPenney place. And we renovated the whole thing. And I was part of mall culture for like 3 months. You know, you get up there every day at 7 a.m. You leave at, you know, 5 p.m. But – what was funny about it is you learn a lot about the mall at the time. This was back in the 90s. And malls would open up early, and they would allow older people to come in and do mall walking. Did you know this?
No.
And you could – this started, I think, in the 80s, early 90s, where older people would walk in the mall, and they would know how many laps were a mile. And there's a whole community of these people. They're actually – they actually sell sneakers called mall walkers. But unfortunately, some of the souls in this movie are too obese or out of shape to walk. But
I do. I love that. I love their inclusion, though.
But. Yeah, exactly. I kind of wish, you know, we had seen more how the mall, like, helps affix its community. But it's true. It's true. And you might think to yourself, well, that's pathetic. Well, the mall's safe. It's clean. It's you won't get rained on. Like, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, the weather's consistent, yeah.
Yeah, and I just never understood why, like, the mall couldn't evolve along with the community to become more of the community.
Yeah.
But I think it is, in a way. I didn't really realize this until after I started researching it, because I'm not a big YouTube fan, but apparently the dead malls genre on YouTube is huge.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple people who are just, they go to abandoned malls and stuff. I think you and I have maybe talked about it at one point.
Well, I feel silly for saying I wasn't really aware of it, because a couple years ago on this very podcast, right, on the Pop Zara podcast, I actually talked to a guy.
He's a
photojournalist.
Right. Yeah.
His name is Seth Lawless, and he actually autopsied dead malls. And I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But no, I talked to him about this. But this was just – he did this amazing still photography, and he would go and document dying malls. And I can't help but think that the directors of this film were inspired by a lot of this content. And they thought, hey, I want to do that. I want to make a film. But instead of just filming the bones, you know, they found life.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they did, because this is my favorite type of documentary, by the way. The documentary when it knows to shut up and let me take it in.
Yeah, it's very kind of unbiased, just neither good nor bad view of the situation, just showing it, right?
Yeah, I don't think this film at all passes judgment. I don't think it's trying to talk, like, there's none of those, can I say it, Ethan? There's none of that insipid animation that you see in documentaries today where they animate characters talking, or they show statistics with, like, sound effect, like, boop, 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 boop. Like, in 1990, you know, statistics showed, like, none of that stuff. It's just, here's the people, as they are, take it in, make up your own mind.
Yeah.
And for that reason alone, it gets a thumbs up for me. It's a very, cool. It's a very psychologically educational film for me.
Yeah. I will say, the first time I watched it, I had so many thoughts. My notes were ridiculous. And then the second time, I haven't watched it in a few months. I watched it a couple nights ago. I had completely new observations from the movie, and just things that I had never noticed before, even maybe like building upon what I noticed last time. I love – this is one thing I did notice the first time. I love the two women outside talking about, and the one woman talking about – she wants to get out of this town, go to someplace new. You know, she's tired of this fishbowl town. Then it's contrasted earlier with the old guy on the oxygen talking about – he's very jovial, talking about – you know, he's a guy's probably in his 80s, talking about, you know, from the last time I was dead, he was declared dead three times. And he said he said, I know what heaven looks like. I'm looking forward to it. To him, there is somewhere bigger, and he's eager to get there, but he knows that it'll happen in good time. But for now – he's perfectly content living out his days playing dominoes with his friends. Jasper doesn't seem so bad to him.
Spoiler, he doesn't survive the film.
Yeah,
so.
He doesn't. And he died. So the last line of the film is, you know, that the gentleman on oxygen, yeah, he passed away the other day. So it's and that alone to me kind of is a microcosm of the theme of the movie, how some people see it as you know, a symbol of how this town is wrecked and how they want to leave. Other people see it as like the highlight of their week or going to this mall.
I would add to that too. I agree with that. But I would also say that I think the filmmakers may have been a little pessimistic and maybe feeling proud of themselves that this mall was going to deteriorate and they were capturing the last moments.
Maybe.
But I'm glad they weren't, because I have faith in America and I have faith in people. And every, you know, and when you watch something like this at Nomad's Land, in some small part, you feel like you're supposed to be depressed. But at the same point, though, you feel like there's something else going on besides. Like we talked about Nomad's Land with Frances McDormand's character. We're supposed to feel like she's representative. But all around her, people are being successful. They're owning houses. They're getting jobs. It's the choices that she's making that are impacting her universe. Same with here. Like you said, you see the girls that are sitting around wondering if something's better, but then you see the fat, jovial guy who's resigned himself to his destiny. Yeah. And again, you also see, you know, what happened to the teenager who's going to take a job for $8 an hour? What happened to the army people? Like,
and the other kid who's moving to Ohio, he's got a new,
exactly. We never follow them, but if you read between the lines, you realize that life goes on and our circumstances are not dedicated by our zip code necessarily, but by our ambitions. And I think this movie makes that clear if you know where to look.
Yeah.
That you don't, that, you know, the past doesn't need to impose itself on the future. Like a mall Santa trying to get you to buy some crap you don't want. So, but no, I really appreciate you really harassing me about Jasper Mall, because I'm glad you did, because I was waiting to watch this, and I will tell you this, had I watched this earlier, this probably would have made one of my best of 2020s.
Really?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I just told you, this new Ryzen documentary, these fake documentaries about rock stars and entertainers, I can't stand them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, I don't care about Britney Spears that much. You know,
And on top of it, Jasper Mall looks really good. It's like very, beautiful. Very picturesque. It's a lot of photography, you know, active photography. I don't know what you call that, live photography. But
you know what's fun though? Like the cameras they're using in all these films, like digital movies have never looked better.
Yeah,
it's so pretty.
They can use rack focus, focus pools. It's really cool.
Yeah, and it looks great in 4K. So if you have a 4K, watch it. By the way, first time I watched it on an iPad. Yeah, and then I had to watch it again on a big screen just to take it in. Cool. So, do I have any other clips from this thing? Let me see if I have any clips. I do not have any other clips, but I will say this. You and I, before we close out, I just wanted to list a couple mall movies. So, just for fun, we already mentioned a couple. We mentioned Fast Times at Ridgemont High, 1982, believe it or not. Same year as this, pretty much the same idea when Jasper Mall was built. We mentioned Valley Girl. But let's just go up a little list real quick, not to berate any of these, but I'm going to go down the list. So we mentioned Wonder Woman 1984. There's a big mall scene in there. There's been a slew of mall movies, but most of them hit about 10 years ago. But we have Observe and Report with Seth Rogen. Mm-hmm. We have Paul Blart Mall Cop, which I think they made a sequel to. Bad Santa, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Really good.
By the way, one of the best mall movies too, by the way. If you haven't seen Bad Santa, don't watch it. Watch Badder Santa, better movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of New Hampshire malls, there's one you might have not known it was a New Hampshire mall movie, but Eight Crazy Nights with Adam Sandler.
Huh.
The animated Hanukkah movie took place in a mall.
That's cool.
I know. Nobody saw this movie, but it exists. we get Clueless, which I think is right around the same time as Mallrats.
Yeah.
Which, again, is going for that subversive mall humor from the early 90s. Here's a movie that is a terrible film, but I only included it because of the name. Scenes from a Mall with Woody Allen and Bette Midler.
If you type mall movies, that's usually Mallrats comes up first, and then either Fast Times or Scenes from a Mall are like the next ones that come up.
Scenes from a Mall is not a great movie, but it's got a really good scene when Woody Allen and Bette Midler are arguing with each other, because Woody Allen, he did not direct this movie, by the way, when he is confessing that he had an affair, and he's like, keep it down, and she's like, nobody is listening to us. And that's something you can do in a mall. And I wanted to just say this real quick. One thing I miss about the malls is that you could go into the food court. You can go to a mall, and if you get the right place, you could do whatever you want, and nobody's paying attention to you.
Yeah, because it's so crowded.
It's so crowded, and it's so liberating because, ironically, you're in the middle of this big, massive amount of humanity, and you blend in like a minnow, and no one cares. But one of my favorite movies from the mall, Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Very brief.
Brief, but memorable, by the way. Speaking of that, we have a movie that's very infamous, Chopping Mall, a.k.a. Killbots. I believe there's a lot of death scenes in a mall gymnasium in that movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Killbot. I'm sorry, I haven't seen Chopping Mall in a long time. The box cover for Chopping Mall is awesome, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, Chopping Mall has an amazing poster. If you haven't seen it, watch Chopping Mall.
Speaking of posters and Mallrats, Drew Struzan did the art for
Did he?
Yeah.
The original?
Yep.
Drew Struzan, by the way, is the greatest movie poster man of all time.
Oh, yeah. Everyone knows him. Even if you don't know you know him, you know him.
By the way, it's one of the reasons I don't like Mondo posters, because everyone tries to imitate the Drew Struzan thing, and all they're doing is they're just using Photoshop. and it's not actual artwork. They're aping his style with no substance.
He actually would draw the characters, yeah.
Yeah, Drew Struzan is the best. Yeah. He is the Norman Rockwell of movie posters, by the way. Yeah, he's awesome. Okay, now the next couple of movies I'm going to talk about have all one thing in common. They all take place, they only have scenes in the malls, and they're all action. And I'm just gonna go bump from the bottom up. 1985's Commando, which has one of the greatest mall scenes of all time, with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Alyssa Milano. One of the crappiest action movies, but what a good mall scene, Invasion USA with Chuck Norris.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that.
It's a canon film. It's gloriously stupid. There's no point in talking about the story. It just takes place in a mall, and you could tell everything's practical effects. But for my money, the greatest mall scene of all time in any movie that has ever been filmed was 1985's Police Story with Jackie Chan. If you haven't seen the movie's fun. But watch the mall scene. It's one of those things where you can't even imagine how much planning went into it. It's this great action scene which Jackie's falling from like three stories, and the glass and everything is flying all around him. And it's Jackie Chan in his prime, in Police Story, in a mall.
Yeah.
It's really awesome, and that's all I have to say. Police Story, the original, not the not new Police Story, not Police Story 2 or 3, Police Story, 1985.
That's the one he really got his notoriety from, right, in America?
I don't want to get it too much because it's a long story, but long story short, Jackie Chan keep having these aborted American movie attempts, and none of them worked. And if you watch Police Story and you go watch, like, The Big Brawl or Cannonball Run, and I forget the other one he made, like, the kinetic energy in the Chinese movie, in the Hong Kong movies, was so much better. Like, this movie would never get made in America just because the amount of stuntmen that probably died making this movie. Wow. Like, when you see it, it's one of the things where they knew it was going to be awesome, so they filmed it from, like, 20 different angles. Huh. It's just, you'll see it. Police Story, mall scene, it's on YouTube. Look it up. You don't need to know the story. The story doesn't matter. So, but yeah, there's tons more, too, but those are the best ones.
You forgot one. Mm. My favorite mall scene of all time.
What's that?
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, I did. I forgot.
The climax.
And can I just say this, about the mall scene with Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? By the way, history lesson at the mall.
Yeah.
What the hell? Yeah. But I think one thing, though, Bill and Ted actually portended the future. Do you know why? Because a very important scene from Bill and Ted didn't take place in the mall. It took place outside the mall. And you start seeing that a lot in 80s movies where the mall would be in the background. Like, you have, like, Back to the Future took place outside in a mall parking lot. You had Jackie Brown very famously took outside a mall parking lot. You had these really famous scenes outside the mall. And I think it's really its own genre, inside the mall movies and outside the mall movies. And by the way, and if I could just say the ultimate mall movie of all time, and I'm sorry, I'll fight you to the death. The most iconic mall movie of all time is not Mallrats. It's Dawn of the Dead.
I was going to say you also forgot Dawn. That was the other one I was
going to. I wanted to save it because Dawn of the Dead, the original 1978, not the 2004, mostly decent remake by Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Is a awesome movie that the mall itself is essential.
Yeah.
And it created an entire genre of horror. But mostly that, though, it's everything. First of all, I love Dawn of the Dead. I will defend the movie and its faults.
Oh, it's so good.
But I will say this. It's commentary on the culture, commentary on our society, commentary on everything. It is actually like a prequel to Mallrats in a way. Because,
because no one's shopping in that movie.
No one's shopping in the movie, but even though they're dead, they still want to get back in.
Yeah.
See, malls are so essential that not even death can keep you away from them. Mm-hmm. And it's got amazing music, by the way. It's got music that does not fit any scene in the movie. Yeah.
Probably my favorite 70s horror. And no, definitely my favorite 70s horror.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time, but I do love its sequel more for different, completely different reasons. But that's like, you have two kids, right?
Yeah.
And if I asked you who's your favorite, you would tell me a bald-faced lie. You would say, oh, I love them both equally. No, you like one more than the other. You just don't know it. And so that's how my love for these zombies movies goes. Like, I love Dawn of the Dead, but I also love Day of the Dead, but I think I love Day of the Dead a little more.
Yeah. Day of the Dead is a little deeper about, like, society and stuff.
It's scary. It's scary.
Pretty terrifying.
No, it's terrifying.
Dawn of the Dead is just so much fun, though. It's one of the most fun movies you'll
Dawn of the Dead. Movies. Dawn of the Dead is so likable. It's so much fun. It's very funny too, by the way. It's got the greatest line ever. Spam. Don't knock it. It's got its own key. And it's got the line something about, you know, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will rise to earth. But the truth is no, the dead will not come to earth. They'll go to malls. They'll go to malls and they'll shop. They'll shop till you drop because you've been listening to the Pop Czar Podcast's own Movie Time Podcast. That's right, movies. And today's duo were none other than 1995's Mallrats by Kevin Smith and 2020's Jasper Mall by Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb. If I'm saying Brad's name wrong, too bad. It's canon. So I want to thank our special co-host, Ethan Brehm. Ethan, these are your movies. You picked well.
Thank you.
We're gonna follow this up with something cool. This has been Nathan Evans, managing editor of PopZara.com. Once again, thanking everybody for listening. If you like what you heard, then give us a good shout-out, give us a like, give us a good review, because we need more of you guys, and we will see everybody at the mall. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Pop Czar Podcast. For more quality original content, check out PopZara.com for the latest reviews and previews in gaming, movies, tech, and more.